Sharon Kick. This is my second week here at Holden. I was here last week and did classes in vocational choices, stress management, burnout, and midlife transitions. So if you had any of those experiences that you were looking forward to dealing with, I'm sorry. we'll be able to deal with them under a new topic. Now, it's called the Developing the Self Concept. And we're going to do some things today on how the self-concept develops. Tomorrow we'll deal with the repair process in terms of self-esteem, how when our self-concept is injured, how our feelings help us deal with the injury, and what's the source of a good repair process, and what are the problems with negative or bad repair processes. By the middle of the week, we'll talk about parts of the self-concept which you may have, which are in fact sort of self-defeating kinds of styles. And on Thursday, or Friday and Saturday, we'll deal with how you change yourself. You know, talk about why change is so difficult and what you can do to change your self-concept. Are there any extra copies of the handouts? There are a few more people coming in. Actually, I had some more run off in the mail room, but then I couldn't get into the mail room because it's locked. I didn't figure out how to get in there. So if you're not getting a copy of the outline and want it later, I will get that from Paula tomorrow morning. There are a couple books that I'd like to recommend. These are just absolute classics in terms of self-esteem. And those of you who have done work in self-esteem probably already know these books. This one called Your Child's Self-Esteem by Dorothy Corgill Briggs. And this book, Self-Esteem, A Family Affair by Jean Isley Clark. Both of these are excellent books. If I had to buy one, you just have to look through them and see which one would best suit your needs. They're both really excellent books. I'm still recommending to people, Please Understand Me, which we used last week in terms of vocational choices. The way that it's related to self-esteem is that there's a chapter in here on children and temperament, which has to do with sometimes a child is born into our family who is not at all like the parents. And those issues in terms of self-esteem are the most difficult ones, because it's easier for us to affirm people who are like ourselves. So this offers a suggestion about, number one, if you in fact are a child who was raised in a family and you're the sort of oddball in your family, it might explain why it was so hard for your parents to parent you well. And if you have someone in your family who is not at all like you and your spouse, it might help you to have more tolerance for that child's growing. So I'm still recommending this book, and this is in the bookstore also. Now we're going to have some time when we do some sort of small group conversation. We have to be real attentive to the fact that there's a group in the other room. So usually with great enthusiasm, people will turn and talk to their neighbors, and we still want that same amount of enthusiasm. But I want you to be sure to sit real close together and sort of talk in a tone, remembering that this many people talking, that noise goes right through the wall. So we will have some time when I will want you to talk with someone near you. My work is that I'm a director of educational services at a hospital in Edmonds, Washington, Stevens Memorial Hospital. I do staff training and management training, and in my other recent past was a director of outdoor ministries for Camp Luther Haven on Lake Coeur d'Alene. So I've done that kind of staff work and worked with congregations and did retreats and some of those kinds of things. The self-concept and self-esteem. Now, for some of you, this may be old, but I'm assuming that you like to hear it. So if you're here, to hear it again. The self-concept typically is defined as how we think about ourselves, and self-esteem is how we feel about ourselves. And as we talk about the relationship between the self-concept and self-esteem, what happens is that it's the goal of self-esteem to keep our feelings about ourselves sort of in line with our picture of ourselves. When we talk about change, what we will recognize is that even when we make a decision to, in fact, enlarge our self-concept, that is, to learn to think better about ourselves, it often becomes the function of our self-esteem to keep us down. So self-esteem can be real tricky, and we're going to talk about that even more a little later in the week. But a very general definition of the self-concept is how we think of ourselves, and self-esteem is how we feel about ourselves. Obviously, feelings have to do with how we think. But the two issues that are always critical in terms of the self-concept is being lovable and capable. And this has to do with just being, and this has to do with doing. And as we talk more about development of the self-concept, many families have lots of messages about one area and maybe not so many messages about another area. So you may identify for yourself sort of a tilt in the system where you were given some messages about being lovable, about your being, just being wonderful, but there wasn't much expected of you in terms of performance. Or you may have a lot of messages about how you should perform, how you should behave, what you should do, but not a lot of messages about just being wonderful for just being alive. So those are the two issues that we're always dealing with in terms of the self-concept. The three functions that are most important in terms of developing the self-concept are mirroring. This isn't on the outline, so you may want to jot this down. So mirroring, idealization, and alter ego. The alter ego. Okay, mirroring, idealization, and the alter ego. And I'm going to talk a little about how that happens. And I think as I do that, you'll see how that it's like how those behaviors serve to define a person's self. It's it may be for good or ill that when babies are born, they don't have a sense of themselves. They really are with some respect of what's going to happen genetically, they're really totally dependent on what happens outside of them to get a sense of themselves. And we often even use that expression. It's like, in certain kinds of surroundings, we have a better sense of ourselves than in other places, because somehow we're getting back from the environment some triggers or some clues that we are accepted or that we're okay in that kind of an environment. So, and it's, I think the mirroring function is probably the easiest one to think of, particularly because we have so many little babies around here this week. That, and if most of us remember when you interact with the baby, I mean, even just the physical thing about when you make little faces and the baby learns to make little faces back, I mean, that's the most literal understanding of the mirroring function. That children, as a way of building their self-concept, literally take from the environment the picture, the response of other adults, usually primarily parents, and sort of take that upon themselves. So, again, sometimes, this is just sort of a happenstance of birth. There are lots of little babies that are born that are just delightful little babies. And they're, they laugh quickly. And there are lots of us that, when it's time for us to have children, we're just delightful little adults. And we're just tickled pink to have these little kids in front of us. And so that mirroring response, when the parent just shows absolute delight and the child reflects that or mimics that or sort of shows it back, is a way that the child begins to develop a self-concept. So that experience of being real attentive, being real connected with a baby, whereby when the baby cries, then the parent also mirrors that and sort of acknowledges that that's what's happening. Sort of a negative example of mirroring is when the little kid, by the time he's old enough to talk, says, "I'm hungry." And the parent, who thinks it isn't time for dinner, says, "No, you're not hungry. No, you're not hungry yet. It isn't 5 o'clock. See, that's an example of not mirroring. When the child sort of speaks out of his or her environment, his or her reality, what the self needs is a perfect mirror of that, which acknowledges then that the child's picture of him or herself is accurate. That is, it's reflected as accurate by some adults. I think the reason there are more books and articles and concern about self-esteem now, say, than there was even 15 or 20 years ago, is that it used to be the job of many people in extended family situations to provide these mirroring kinds of behaviors. And when we have lots of adults around, or even older siblings around, to mirror, to give the child a picture back of what was going on, the child had more than one or two people to somehow learn his or herself from. Now, very often, you know, people are raising children in isolation, and it's one parent and one or two or three or four children, or two parents and one or two or three or four children. The need for that mirroring function is still there, but the stress on those people who are needed to mirror is even harder because they're the ones only ones giving the pictures. After kids go away from home, they still look for mirroring. You know, we still, in fact, look for mirroring behaviors. When we think about our own self, for example, if you know you go to a friend and you say, you know, I just lost my job, what you want is empathy, which is another, you know, sort of an adult experience of mirroring. What we want is someone whose feeling state matches our feeling state and whose sense of what happened to us matches ours so that we can talk about that, so that we can express it. And that's the mirroring experience. You can imagine then what happens with the development of the self when you go back to the situation of an infant who's very, very, very dependent, cries because they're hungry, and the message from the outside is not a mirroring message at all, but it's, you know, it isn't 5 o'clock yet. In fact, we know that there were generations of people raised who were told that they could only be fed every 4 hours. So again, some of these are sort of happenstances of culture. Sometimes little babies are real colicky, and they just cry and cry and cry and cry and cry for 9 months. It is very tough to be, you know, a supportive mirroring parent for a baby who, again, because of an accident of his or her own birth, has gas for 9 months. Most of us wouldn't be nice to another adult who had gas for 9 months, let alone to a baby. I'm talking about this because I think that we need to see that none of us either was parented or is likely to parent perfectly. And part of the thing around looking at the self-concept is to identify what kinds of things are we likely to do well or probably went well for us, and where are the places that were difficult? Because those are the places when we deal with our own self-concept and change, and when we deal with self-esteem, those are the places where we continue to keep ourselves in trouble, maybe even keep ourselves in the same kind of trouble we experienced when we were infants. Okay, are there any questions about the mirroring function? I mean, what that is and what it's for? You know, when the little kid comes in and, you know, shows you this big glob of ugly stuff and is just delighted and goes, oh, look what I just did. You know, the attention ought not to be the mess on the floor. I mean, for a minute, the mirroring response of that's just wonderful. You know, then you can still be sure that the mess doesn't get all over the floor. But that's an example of a mirroring kind of behavior. When my oldest girl was real little, she got into the Desitin. Anybody not remember Desitin? I mean, it sticks to everything. It's just, you know, it's perfect if you're trying to protect a bottom from anything. But, it smells terrible. I mean, I wasn't particularly prejudiced against Norwegians because that's my family background. But it says right on there, Norwegian cod liver oil. I go, ugh. So it smells bad. It's sticky. She got into it one day and put it all over the dresser. I mean, we were using a dresser as a changing table for her and for her brother. Right now we had a brother. And she just put it everywhere. And I mean, I just thought it was awful. My husband came home from work and quickly got into how wonderful it must have felt on her hands and how wonderful she must have felt to be spreading this stuff evenly all over this dresser. That's a mirroring kind of thing. Doesn't mean that we don't have to clean up the mess. But at that point, Bob was much quicker than I to mirror that behavior. Tracy clearly didn't do it to be bad. She was doing it because of the, you know, the sensation of it. So, I mean, for a moment, to mirror, you know, to have that moment where you share that same experience. The idealization has to do with, again, this. It's almost easiest to give this example by sort of a negative example to recognize how it happens, that children will always idealize their parents. what we know in abuse situations is that children, even after having been abused, will go back to their parents for love. And they go back because they believe that that's a definition of love. I mean, you can imagine how distorted that is and why that's so painful and why it's so hard to get over. But it's this process of the self developing to idealize the parents. It's, you know, it's not an error that we have for all those years talked about when we pray the Our Father, when we have children whose idealization of the Father is not you know, a gracious one, why that gets to be trouble. Because children simply translate that the grown-ups in their lives are the gods. And however they treat them is how they deserve to be treated. See, that's the idealization function. Well, you know, when that goes well, that's a wonderful lesson to be learned. When the self-concept of the parents is good and their self-esteem is high, the idealization is, I mean, turns out to be wonderful because these are cherished, chosen, delighted in children. But we can see how when that gets distorted, what that does, because the infant idealizes that the big people in their lives know everything. I mean, some of you will probably remember those years when the kids thought you knew everything. I mean, they think you know invisible things. I mean, it's kind of nice. It's fun. It's usually a lot of delightful stories that come out of this kind of idealization. But as you can see, I mean, there's just terror that comes out of that as well. And we're going to talk about that a little more with some of the notes on the paper. The thing about the alter ego that's important has to do with what in sort of in adult psychological terms is like extended empathy. It's like when someone talks to you and you really get it. And it's like if you take parent effectiveness training or any of those effectiveness training classes, when you do active listening and someone says something to you and you go a little beyond what they've said to indicate that you really understand what they're talking about, you really comprehend. That's what the alter ego function does in terms of the self-development. That in fact, a parent who is real tuned in to a child in terms of development will understand when a kid comes in and says, "Hey mom, look at this," that there's more to it than that. That there's more to it than just literally look at this. So the function of the alter ego, it would be the same as it is with us. It's like if someone, I don't know how many of you have ever done alter ego kinds of activities, but they're really fun. It's like two people engage in activities, and then two people stand behind them. And to these two people are talking, and the people behind them say what they imagine they're thinking. And every once in a while, it's like when you're in the chair and somebody's right on, it's like it's real unnerving because somebody is somehow in you almost more really than you are yourself. And that's the function of the alter ego in terms of the, you know, the parent or the adults in the life of a developing child. So that it's like they get it. They really get it when the kid says, "I made a mess in my room." You know, it's not only just clean up the mess, but, you know, am I in trouble? Am I bad? You know, all of those things. So that they take time. And this does require time. As a parent, I have often, sort of at the end of the day, you know, how many certain events will come back, and it still happens to me even now. I'll have conversations with people, and later in the day you think, you know, so-and-so said X to me, and I said X, but I think what she was really saying was this other thing, and I totally missed it. I mean, I wasn't even there for it. I just, like, I was real busy and real preoccupied. I mean, you know, it would take the saints to do all this perfectly. And they, of course, then, you know, would develop saints. most of us are forgiven saints because for a whole variety of reasons, we were not able to do all those things perfectly. We are not able to do them even now with people who are less vulnerable than infants. And the world doesn't do this for us either. And that's why the whole issue of the self-concept and self-esteem is both an issue of parenting infants, and it's also an issue for us of parenting ourselves. Okay. I'll pause long enough to see if there are any questions or comments or reflections on this. This is primarily from the work of a man named Heinz Kohut, K-O-H-U-T. Those of you who want to look for some of the things that are written, Kohut's the person that I'm familiar with who does the most about the development of the self. Okay, back to the outline a little bit. When we talk about the development of the self, we're talking about the development of boundaries, and that's how these things happen. These things serve the development of boundaries. Ultimately, what happens is that a child is meant to develop two things, both the will to understand and the ability to distinguish between thinking and feeling. That if, as the child develops, if all this has happened, then they can deviate from this. It's like we don't all go through life watching for everybody to nod when we nod. You know, at some point, we're perfectly free to own our own self-understanding of something and deal with lots of people who disagree. So if, in fact, the mirroring happened, then we can get into discriminating between good ideas and bad ideas, discriminating between things that we ought to do and shouldn't do, discriminating between things that are important to us and things that are not important to us. But primarily, what happens is that a child develops the will to understand and the ability to distinguish between thinking and feeling. In terms of the will to understand, it's, again, this is one of those things that if you don't know what's happening, you can be real irritated. I think it must be at the middle grades where kids do a lot of blaming, like the teacher was stupid. You know, how many people in here have kids whose teachers are stupid? You know? And I hate that. I mean, I always get so angry. There's a part of me that goes, you know, don't you want to take any responsibility for this? Well, there's sort of a developmental stage where it's actually healthy for the kid to say the teacher was stupid. Because the flip of that is I'm stupid. And it's a way, you know, it's rationalization, which isn't a particularly sophisticated adult defense. But it's okay for little kids. Because it's a way for them to distinguish between, it's a way for them for their, to like to save themselves, for their self-esteem to save themselves. And so it's like they did it. And those of us who are, you know, sort of more whole and want people to sort of own up to what they've done, just have to bite the inside of our cheeks those years. I mean, there's many years we have to bite the inside of our cheeks. But that whole process of rationalizing actually at some stages is a healthy stage. You'll begin to figure out, you know, when it isn't. It's like there's, after sort of junior high, you want kids not to have all of their teachers be stupid and for all of their mistakes to be somebody else's mistake. The second thing that happens, it's like if a kid doesn't do this, doesn't push away, what they're more likely to do is introject. And that means they take on, it means to eat whole, swallow whole, everybody's assessment of them. And see, we don't want that. We when they're an infant, that's what happens. They totally introject. They take on everybody else's assessment of them and swallow it whole and assume that if this is who mommy says I am, this is who I am. If this is who dad says I am, this is who I am. Later on, you know, we don't want them to begin to keep on swallowing whole everyone else's judgment. So, ironically, it's one of those things that if they did that well as an infant, they don't have to keep doing that. So if they have a picture of themselves as a healthy, okay human being, then when some problem comes up, they have a way to deal with that doesn't say, oh, I really am just, I mean, I'm just a mess. I mean, I'm just a bad kid. On the other hand, if they've been eating, I'm a bad kid for all these years, when they hear that later on, that's the one they believe. Question about either rationalization or introjection? Those are sort of the extremes, but as you know, we all go through sort of stages of development. So most of us, it's like when you, sometimes you can think about the self-concept development mostly when you can remember yourself when you feel bad. It's like it's one of those things that you learn about in the deficit. And most of us will do one or the other of these more, you know, we're more prone usually to either taking stuff on or blaming. And even then we recognize, I don't usually do it this. I mean, I must be in a lot of pain. And we recognize it sort of after we've done it for a while. But most of us will err on one side or the other, which indicates, you know, that was a problem for us in terms of the development of our self-concept. That's something that we didn't get handled real well. So we're likely either to continue to rationalize or to continue to just swallow whole people's assessment of ourselves. The ability to distinguish between thinking and feeling is real important. Again, it's like you have to have some kind of a sense of yourself. But as the self develops to learn that feelings, that the whole range of feelings is okay, but that the thinker in us makes decisions about how to act on those feelings. I mean, that's why to be able to distinguish between thinking and feeling is such an important process in the development of the self. Because if we don't do that, then we are prone to simply act on all of our feelings and act without understanding of why we're acting. So the ability to distinguish between thinking and feeling is a real important concept in terms of self-development. And I think it's why it's why we have books, you know, by Briggs and Clark. Because for many people, even to deal with the whole realm of feelings was not okay. So for many of us, that's a brand new skill. It's not a skill that's been handed down from generation to generation. It's a skill that we've had to learn in our families, to talk about our feelings and to distinguish them about what we want to do about that. You know, what kinds of behaviors are acceptable. And the thinker does that. So if you know someone who simply, you know, acts without thinking, that's a, again, that's part of the development of the self that they may have missed. And then what you want to do is either get in communication skills classes or in some kind of classes that help people learn to distinguish, learn to name their feelings. It's usually what people need to do. It's the feeling side that we've neglected. And when you neglect that, you know, ironically, what you don't have is a thinker, because that's all you have is the feeling side. Okay. Questions on any of this?
Sharon,
Slow down and let me ask a question.
Yeah, well, Sharon, I'm not getting the part about the will to understand. The will to understand myself, the will to understand who I am. Is that what that...
But it's even littler than that. The will to understand would be to make sense of my own experience. When the child begins to develop the will to understand, what they're doing is they're moving away from having their whole experience interpreted by this, you know, this image, you know, giver. And it's like, if this is done well, then we simply can take on that function, so that a child can say, they can sort of know the difference between when they did something wrong and someone else did something wrong, or when they're doing well or not doing well. It's not necessarily the will to understand my whole life. It's the will to understand what's happening. You know, what's happening in, you know, between me and my brother. What's happening when mom and dad are fighting. You know, is this a problem for me or is it them? It's what it means is that a sufficient boundary has been developed so that the kid knows the difference between this is me and you're over there. That's maybe a better way to explain.
Thanks.
Okay.
Sure.
Uh huh.
What I've gotten from what you said so far is that everything is based on environment. But are all babies? Would two babies be equally receptive to the exact same input? I mean, don't babies have some personality just to start with?
Right, they probably do, because what they have is all the genetic stuff. So, for example, you may have a child who's real active. The mirroring behaviors for a real active child may be real different for you than the mirroring behaviors for a more self-composed child. So those two children are very different. They still need to be mirrored. That is, they need to have, the little kid who's real lively needs to hear back how energy is a good thing. And the little kid who's real self-composed needs to hear back how being able to keep him or herself busy for a little while is a good thing. See, so they can be very different. And our responses would be very different. But the idea is to be able to affirm the child as he or she is.
You don't try to make changes?
What?
You don't try to make changes?
You'll want to set limits. We've got what we're going to talk about, that it's real important for kids to know what the expectations are and to have limits set. But you don't want to make changes in, I mean, the whole style kinds of issues.
I wasn't thinking of that.
Yeah.
I guess I was thinking of the limit.
Yeah, we're going to talk about limits, and limits are really important. Yeah. I know some people who were expecting their first baby sort of in their 40s, and the man said to me, because they live they're very quiet, they're both very introverted people, real private, essentially real quiet. They run a pretty quiet house, two quiet adults. And he said, I'm kind of worried about this, this baby. But then I suppose, the baby will probably be just like me and my wife, so she'll probably be real quiet too. And I thought, well, maybe. Maybe not. But, if you go just with heredity, and you go, these two nice, quiet adults, we're going to have a baby that's just like us. Well, sometimes, sometimes not. So and that's why, again, that's why it's difficult. Because what we can often do is mirror back the things that we already value in ourselves. But what we're called upon to do is to mirror back something that may be very different from us. Mirroring in terms of valuing and cherishing and delighting in. Without letting things just run crazy. Yeah. Okay.
Sure. Where would a victim, something really bad happens to somebody and they kind of go through life being a victim, would that be like a blaming? Is that the mode or?
Mm-hmm. And I think it's about, let's see, Monday, Tuesday, I think it's Thursday, we're going to talk about modeling, sex roles, and injunction kinds of things that people get into that may in fact be keeping you from the kind of self, it's a reflection of the fact that your self-concept isn't as whole as you need it to be. And so I think we'll do a little more on that. But it's what happens is that's somebody who hasn't been affirmed, who found a style of dealing with that, essentially found a coping style that's not very healthy. The people who sort of get into a victim stance.
When about the rationalization, I think I kind of respond to my teacher is stupid type statements the way you do. And I was wondering what your ideas are for dealing with kids who make those kinds of statements.
Are you happen to be a teacher?
But no.
Oh. Well,
I've taught kids before in informal settings at church.
Mm-hmm.
Or just had to deal with them when they're confiding in me as the big friend.
Mm-hmm. Usually what's behind the teacher is stupid is, that they're feeling bad about something. So again, it's what you want them to do is talk about what happened that they felt bad. And that's a way, again, you don't necessarily have to tell them not to blame the teacher, but by your not asking them what's wrong with the teacher, but by asking them what happened to them, you sort of helping the process to develop. You help them to think about what the effect was on them. And they'll keep telling you the teacher was stupid, but in the process they'll tell you that they studied the wrong things. Something like that.
What made you feel that way?
That's right. Yeah. So you don't have to, they don't have to end with a punchline that says, well, it really was my fault, teacher isn't so stupid. But after a while, they'll get that.
Mm-hmm. They'll pick that up.
The parenting styles contributing to a low self-esteem and a low self-concept, in some ways, are the flip sides of these. And they are, in fact, the things that we do sometimes out of our most conscientious, careful, wonderful, we think, selves, that tend to go awry. And, I look at all this stuff. I'm 45, and my kids are 17 and a half, 18 and a half, and 19 and a half. 17 and a half. Yeah, that's it. Well, they're close together. Somebody, Dwayne, the musician, and his wife are in the village, and they have a 2-year-old with them who cried a long time trying to get down for her nap. And so then I came down the stairs and told them who I was, and I was doing classes on self-esteem, and they went, oh. I remember all the years when the kids, do cry. It's very difficult. There's almost no list of the stuff that I can look at and not remember how painful it was to, especially. It's like, even if I had known then what I know now, I couldn't have done it perfectly. I may have done some things differently, but I couldn't have done it perfectly. And so part of it is that we need to have some affection for ourselves. But, here's a list of all the things we could do wrong, and there may be more. Being overprotective. What does a kid learn? What are the lines? What are the overprotective lines that the parents use?
Be careful.
Don't go too far.
fast, too slow, too high, too low.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. And what do they end up meaning? What, I mean, if we're talking about development of the self concept, what do they end up meaning in terms of the self? Yeah, you won't be able to make choices. You know, you're not capable. The world is not a safe place. You know, a lot of those are not trust kinds of things. I lived in a generation where, every time I went anywhere, you know, my mom said, be careful. Now, I am sure have overcorrected because I tell my kids to have a good time. You know, we're in trouble for that, too. You know? But isn't it true? They're just, we must have whole generations of people. I don't know if there's a year that will, you know, that we won't have the one about be sure to wear clean underwear in case you're in an accident or go to the hospital. I don't know how far that gets handed down. But what happens is that, you know, these are all reflections of the parents' anxiety about the world. So my mom was more worried about, you know, things not being safe out there. You know, I'm more worried that, you know, life's going to be sort of flat and they're not going to have a good time. So, I don't say that every time they go. I don't even think it every time they go. But I get these little pet lines that I use, and mine is have a good time. You know, that's what you're, you know, sort of out there for. Well, it's not all that they're out there for. How about the critical ones? What are the critical lines?
Yeah. That's good, but.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's a good
You never. You just start every sentence with mm-hmm. you never.
Or you always. Yeah, yeah. That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what are those after? You think? What's happening in the adult when we use those lines?
Well, we've reached the perfection. We've worked through it and reached it, and somehow expect them to already have it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's yeah. It's a double one. It's like not only are they expect to be perfect, the implied thing is that we really are the perfect ones. Because you never do that means we always do it. Okay.
You should never use absolutes.
Right. I think about the, it's like even the way we deal with, with kids spilling stuff and being real cranky and so forth. It's like if the line is that you're bad, or you're clumsy, or you're cranky, instead of, that was too heavy, or you're tired, which helps the kid, again, to interpret his experience, sort of feeds the will to understand instead of feeding the self-concept without making any sense. So those lines that are critical, and toward the middle of the week, we're going to have, each of us trying to figure out, what are some of those that we're still carrying that, we just ate lock, stock, and barrel, that we may need to figure out how to chew up and spit out a little bit at a time. What's exaggerated praise about? Because I think this may be a little tough, but
it's fake.
All right. And what happens? What do you think happens to the kid when they hear that?
They don't believe it.
They don't trust it when you give them earned praise.
Yeah. Yeah. Over here. What's this over here? Yeah, that they essentially, they don't believe it. But what also happens is like, if they're real young, they may believe it. And then what happens, it's like, they do that again and again. And then it's like, I think you're probably the very best tricycle rider in this whole block. You know? I mean, that wouldn't be such an unusual thing to say, would it, when a kid's learning to ride a trike? I think you're probably the best trike rider in the block. You know, you sell it to your kid three or four times and he meets another trike rider on the block and he has trouble. Because, it doesn't match his real experience. And then he thinks he has to check out with this other kid whether or not he thinks he's the best trike rider on the block. I think that's tough because most of us get into the praise stuff, but we have to deal with the fact that they're not going to believe it. And if they're young enough that they do believe it, it gives them an exaggerated sense of themselves. Most of us, when we're talking about self-esteem problems, are talking about a level of a self-concept or esteem that's lower than what we ought to have. Most of us are on the depleted side. But we know people whose sense of themselves is real exaggerated. And they just somehow, they're both problems. This is a problem with somehow being real in the world. They can't pull that off. But But that's a, you know, that's a real tough one to live with. And it's not the same as somebody who brags. The bragging stuff is a correction for low self-esteem. But there simply are people who think that they can do almost anything. And then, you know, again, depending upon how they've internalized that, at some point, you know, the world reminds us that, you know,
they
can pull it out. Yeah, and they may use rationalization longer than is appropriate. Yeah, that would be a good sign of that. That's a good example.
Or couldn't that over-exaggerated praise also create overachievers who are constantly trying to meet that statement of how wonderful they are, and you never can?
Yeah, especially if they can't do it. If they really are achievers, it just, you know, it doesn't necessarily create overachievers. If you're an overachiever who achieves, then, I mean, you're okay. You are on your issue of, I mean, what you really can do. But if you're just always trying to do something better and you're always, you know, your perception of your accomplishment is not real, not realistic. And we often know people whose perception of how well they deal with others, you know, they think they're pretty good with people and they offend people all the time. They just, and they may very well have gotten a lot of praise for that at some point, and they just got out of touch with what was really happening. You know, for those people, what we usually recommend is, you know, lots of sort of action and feedback and action and feedback so that they can get a more realistic perception of themselves. So those are both problems, just that most of us probably don't have the exaggerated praise one. Don't abuse. What's the don't thing? What does that do to a child in terms of developing their self-concept?
Makes them afraid to try anything.
Yeah. Yeah. We had some last week when we talked about burnout. Don't do anything unless you can do it well. That's a tough one. Because then, I mean, how many things can you do well? I mean, just like that.
Two?
That's right. Stand up and sit down. Right? Not very many. Yeah. Lack of respect for the child. This for me, I mean, that's sort of a catch-all, obviously. Lack of respect for the child might mean lack of respect for a child who's different from you. I don't know if the best story, it's certainly one I remember from my daughter was in about the fourth grade. My oldest daughter I'm an intuitive, so I'm real, you know, I'm this, you know, all these gestures. My oldest daughter is a sensate. You know, she's pretty grounded. She's pretty realistic. I mean, if we go for a walk and I just go crazy about, look at the gorgeous moon, look at this, look at that, I mean, it's just like, it's not that big a deal to her. I mean, she doesn't resonate to that same kind of exaggerated description of life. So in her fourth grade, they had a project to, I don't know, they do those beans or something, don't they? Grow those little bean plants or something. Put the bean next to the blotter and put water in it and grows up. And I had a conference with her teacher sort of toward the end of this bean project. And the teacher was really disappointed because Tracy didn't seem to have much interest in this bean project. And I said, well, do you know what Tracy's dad does for a living? No, she didn't know what Tracy's dad did for a living. I said, he owns a greenhouse business. And he's got, you know, little things just growing up like they're supposed to all over the place. And he deals with it the same way Tracy does. It is expected that if you put the water in the whole thing. So for me, that was a wonderful lesson for me about understanding a little bit of why she doesn't go crazy about the moon. And I'd always felt a little offended about that because, you know, I tend to make a big deal about pretty little things. There's a lot of little things in our lives those years, and that's what saved me. That isn't what saves her. So, I mean, it's so that kind of respect for the child is like, is, you know, can you respect the child who's different from you? Can you respect the child who is still a child, you know, doesn't, you know, hasn't pulled off perfection yet? It seems to me that what we want to get at with this, in terms of understanding the self-concept and understanding our own self-esteem, is that probably the most vulnerable our self-esteem is as adults sometimes is around kids and how they respond to us. And we get into this thing, you know, backwards. What we look for is for the child to mirror our reality and for the child to idealize us as a parent by being an ideal child. And for the child to understand that we've had a bad day. Now, part of what we want to do is to develop a system where when the adult has a bad day, there's a way to say that to the child so the child isn't, you know, doesn't take that on. I mean, that's a, you know, that's a nice kind of respect for two or four, however many people in your family, sort of fragile self-esteems from time to time. But it's, you know, some of us remember, particularly if you have any sense of, like, issues of control or it's like little kids will just undo that. Will totally undo that. I mean, it's like their schedule is their schedule, their needs are their needs. And to the extent that, that we want to look like good parents in the face of all of this chaos of an emerging child, they can't pull that off for us. And it seems to me that under the issue of respect for the child is finding a system, we're going to talk about that a little later too, that where the child can be having his or her own experience and we don't take it personally, you know, to the extent that it, that it's a reflection on whether or not we're doing well. What I'd like you to do for a minute, and I want to remind you not to, to talk, you know, real loud, is to have you either, you can think about this either about children, or you can actually identify this even with other adults. It seems to me that if we can identify what's, like, what's the, I mean, which of these things are we more prone to? Are we more prone to being overprotective or critical? Are there certain kinds of behaviors that are often appear in children, but also appear sometimes in adults, that we just have no tolerance for? It's like if we can identify that, then what we know is one part of ourself that still needs to be developing, our self with the big S. Because that's what that is a trigger for. The stuff that we just can't quite stand in other people is the stuff in our own self that hasn't been well developed. And that's why as adults we need to continue to nurture and parent ourselves. So take a minute and see, I mean, if this list helps you, either the overprotective or the critical or the don't or the don't trust or the be careful, or what is it about, you know, some of that part of life that where you get triggered and you know, you know, this is not a problem with them. This is really starting with a problem in me. Do you have a question first?
When we discuss these, are we supposed to identify that which we see in parents that we don't like or that which we're not very good at as parents ourselves?
Well, it might be the very same thing. If you can talk about yourself, that's the best thing. If you don't know it in yourself, all you have to do is try to identify what you're the most critical about in someone else. And that'll be what you most don't like in yourself.
I don't know.
Well, sometimes it might be an issue of boundaries. If in fact you are not critical of certain kinds of behaviors of other adults, and you genuinely are not, but you are critical of that in your own children, I think it's that the mirroring, you know, sort of in reverse, that there's something in them that you don't like. And you don't like it in yourself, and because you're blood. I mean, you're relatives. I mean, it's like if you see that in a stranger, you might not like it, but you may not feel called upon to come out with a heavy hand because you're not taking it personally. It may irritate you. You know, you may choose to be more diplomatic. If you're a supervisor, you may, you know, talk with the person about it. If it's a coworker, you may put up with it. You still don't like it, but it doesn't touch yourself. See, that's the issue where we can identify where our own selves have problems. And it usually is around people where our boundaries aren't real clear. We don't have a sense of our children as being totally separate from us. And when they do things, it's our tendency to think that that's a reflection on us. Or that we are, in fact, we're more invested in that kind of behavior with our children. So we will often be more critical of our children than we are of other people. So it's a boundary issue. The goal, you know, of course, is that, I mean, that we all have different boundaries. I mean, that children ultimately are separate individuals. And we are separate individuals. And when the children have behaviors as young adults or adults that we don't like, it's really then our business to deal with why we don't like that. It's not our business to, you know, sort of manage that out of them. And it may not even be our business to sort of manage that out of them, when they're young. On the other hand, it may be a behavior that's real, real detrimental to that person's development. So you have to make some of those, some of those choices. But that's the issue of parenting, that you start with no boundaries. I mean, the child has no separate self apart from the parent's self, and develops more of that and more of that and more of that. If, in fact, your child has developed a goodwill to understand, he or she may say, God, Dad just hates it when I do this. But actually, that sort of works well for me other places. Dad just hates it. So I won't do it when he's around, but I don't think it makes me a bad person. See, that would be an example of a clear boundary with a child whose self-concept is clear enough that he can tell the difference between his or her own developed styles and the fact that there will be people, including them, their parents, who aren't real happy with them. On that last list, for those of you who didn't get the handout, let me read through this, to the background of Vesper music. Parenting styles contributing to a high self-concept and high self-esteem, full acceptance of the child and unconditional love. Well, that's part of what we've been talking about. It's like, the unconditional love, of course, would be if it were done perfectly. Full acceptance of the child is what we simply try to do as much as we can, as well as we can. Clearly and defined and enforced limits. And I didn't want to let you go until we talked about that. The thing about limits is that then it's very important for a kid to know when they've exceeded limits or got under it. The thing about the doing, I am capable, gets developed when the child has real clear expectations. It's like you clean your room on Saturday morning, you put your toys away, put them back in the box. But that's coupled, in terms of development, with respect for the child. Dorothy Briggs calls it shared power. That families with really high self-esteem, when kids get to be sort of upper elementary, junior high years, there's a lot of talk about, what's okay and what isn't okay. A lot of talk about what time we come in, a lot of talk about limits. It is not a sign of a healthy family when, the father or the mother says, you'll be in at 11 o'clock and the kid just does it. Because at this point, the kid needs to be testing limits. It doesn't mean that 11 o'clock hour is deviated from, but there needs to be a lot of conversation, because what you want to develop is a shared power picture. And the kid needs to understand why, and they need to tell you they hate that, and none of their friends do it, and you need to listen to that. And that's true even if you take, those adolescent years down to the two, which is the first adolescent expression, the terrible two, when the kid is pushing and pushing and you're explaining limits. The limit is just as clear. You can't run into the street. So the limit stays, but the limit is explained. So there's a respect for the child with limits. And ultimately, parental self-esteem is high. And if nothing else, the single most important thing for us to do at any time in our lives, whether we're parents or co-workers or spouses or friends, is to have a system that helps us stay close to and in touch with our best self. We're going to talk more about how to develop that and talk about self-esteem, but it's very important for us to keep our self-esteem high, because then the behavior of others isn't such a big deal. We're not so dependent on it for our feeling okay about ourselves.